So good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. It's wonderful to see so many people here interested in being quiet. It's a great thing. And I want to thank, in her absence, Tara, for being willing to have me speak with you, and all the people, Rose and everybody else who's been so kind to communicate and set everything up, and my dear friend Rosemary, who's been hosting us and putting us up and taking us all around and being over the top kind. So thank you, Rosemary. I want to talk a little bit about our lives, I guess, life. Because I don't think of meditation practice as a special case or a special thing. I think of it as just one really good way of appreciating our lives, kind of getting in tune with what really goes on in our human life. I used to think, you know, I've done Zen practice for a long time and lived in monasteries and so on, and I thought it was very unusual to do that. When I was younger, I thought, wow, this is really unusual. There are not that many people doing this. But after a long time, I realized it's not that unusual. Actually, everybody's doing this. It's an unavoidable aspect of human life. If you're born, and if you understand that someday your life ends, if you are trying to figure out how to love somebody and be loved, if you feel like you need to be doing some work that has purpose and meaning and not just something that's fun, it's good to have fun, but also one needs some purpose and meaning. If you have these kind of issues in your life, and who doesn't? One way or the other, then that means that you're on a spiritual journey and that you can't avoid that. It's, to be human is to have some kind of spiritual life. So I was doing all this Zen meditation and being in monasteries and so on, but actually I realized, oh, everyone is in the monastery with me. We're all in the same boat. We're all really doing the same thing. And the spiritual journey is oddly and strangely a journey home. We're just trying to get home. You know, we're not trying to do something like really special or great or extraordinary. All we're trying to do is return home to the place that we know we belong, but somehow we've lost track of it. In a way, when you see a baby, you feel... this baby is home already. That's why it's so delightful, you know, to see children. Because you feel they're perfectly at home in their skin. I mean, they cry sometimes and they're not without problems. But they're at home in their skin. They're at home. And then we grow up and we leave home. It seems to be necessary for us to leave home. We can't remain babies. You know, it's not our destiny to be in the same condition when we're 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 years old and as we were when we were 1 or 2 months old. So we leave home, but then we have to come back home. And at some point in our lives, we yearn for this. We yearn to come back home, to come back to the place where we know we belong, but somehow have lost track of. So I do a lot of Zen retreats, and in the Zen retreats I usually give a talk every day, an encouragement talk. And so one time I was leading a retreat and had to give a talk, and I thought, well, I'll tell some stories from the Odyssey, because I had been reading the Odyssey at the time. So I was talking about Buddha's enlightenment. It was a Buddha's enlightenment session we have every year in December And in talking about Buddha's enlightenment, I kind of threw in some stories from the Odyssey and tied them in with this and with stories of Buddha's enlightenment. And people really enjoyed those stories. They thought that was the high point of the talk. And later, when I asked them why, they said, well, we love hearing about the Buddha, but the Buddha was so perfect. And he was so determined and so single-minded. He left home. He went off on his spiritual quest, never looking back, devoting 100% of his energies all day long for the rest of his life. And I'm not quite like that. I, you know, blow hot and cold. I mess up quite a few times. I'm going well, and then I kind of fall off my practice and get messed up. And so it was great hearing about Odysseus, because he's a lot like me. He also messes up, and he gets blown back off course, and he messes up, and he has to pay the consequences, and he's going home. And that's what I want to do. I want to go home too. So that sounds like me. So I thought, oh, that's right. You know, that's true. So then I did it again. I had another retreat sometime later somewhere else. And I tried it out again. And people also liked it there. And I got into it more and more. I gave a seminar one time on the Odyssey. I decided I would read the Odyssey as a Buddhist text, as if it were a spiritual text. What would it sound like? What would I find if I assumed that? And then I thought to myself, I bet it really is. I bet it really, why else would it have survived all these thousands of years if it didn't say something about our lives? And maybe what it says about our lives is not obvious or apparent, but it must be that we love this story so much and we want to read it again and again because it's telling us something that we really need to hear about. So I had that thought. And then I began reading the Odyssey with that in mind. And I thought, by God, you know, that really is true. At first I thought, I'm stretching this. But after a while, I thought, no, I really think this is really, I think it's really true that all these great myths and these great stories must be telling us something about our inner lives. And it occurred to me that, you know, so much goes on within us. I was watching a baby, actually. I was in Minneapolis the other day, and I was at the Zen Center, one of the Zen centers there, and somebody had a little baby, little baby boy, and she put him on the floor, and he was just moving around, and you know, babies are just trying to figure out where their arms are and where everything is, and he was just in a state of total delight, and you could see going across his face, so many things were going on. He was having so many profound experiences, and I thought, yeah, we're like that too. We still have all these profound experiences. It's just that we really don't know that they're going on. We don't know what's happening with us. There's so much happening to us. We feel so much, you know, and we experience so much in every hour, every day of our lives. We take in so much, and it affects us. Everything affects us. But most of it we filter out and we don't know about. We see with our eyes, we hear with our ears, we smell with our noses, we think with our minds, we feel with our emotions. But there's more than all that going on. So how do we know about it? And how do we digest it? And how do we understand about it? This is the epigraph for my book here. It's from a book by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. And George is a linguist. Maybe some of you have been hearing about George in the last number of years. He's been became interested from a linguistic point of view in analyzing political rhetoric. So he's been analyzing the sort of metaphorical basis of right-wing rhetoric and left-wing rhetoric, liberal rhetoric and conservative rhetoric. He's been analyzing and writing some very interesting stuff about that. But he began his career with a very thorough analysis of metaphor and how metaphor operates in our language and in our lives. And here's what he says. It is as though the ability to comprehend experience through metaphor were a sense, like seeing or touching or hearing, with metaphors providing the only ways to perceive and experience much of the world. So that's an astonishing idea, isn't it? That there are things going on in our lives that we actually don't have a sense organ or an intellectual organ to perceive. And that the only way, possibly, that we can perceive these things in our lives is through metaphor, as if metaphor were a sense organ, like eyes or ears. That's what he's saying. And all of a sudden, when you hear that, it makes sense, because you realize, well, that's why people keep reading the Odyssey. That's why people are reading the Gospels. That's why people read the Buddhist Sutras. That's why people read poems and literature. And also, why we love music, why we love visual arts. Because these things are giving us a real window onto things that we are experiencing but would have no access to without these metaphorical presentations of them. So it's a very profound discovery, I think, that George made. And in this book, he analyzes our language, and he shows that things that we don't think of as being metaphorical are metaphors embedded in our language, because we can't understand things without these metaphors. Like we say, you know, let's go forward into time. Well, time isn't forward, you know, and yet we have that metaphor in our language. Anyway, the last sentence here: metaphor is as much a part of our functioning as our sense of touch, and as precious. And so, every metaphor yields a different set of perceptions about who we are and what we are. And I'm a person who's always, for some reason, been interested in all the different religions of the world, because each one adds a whole rich metaphorical layer to our all but unknowable inner experience, our all but unknowable spiritual lives. So I thought I'd read a little bit from the book. Okay? I think I'll do that. In reading the Odyssey, one of the things that you notice is that Odysseus, it's set in the Greek islands, and it's as if there's, you know, of course, actually the distances are not that far, but in the Odyssey it makes it sound as if there's a little island here and a vast space between that island and the next one, and another one over here and another one over there. So all the action is taking place on these islands, and then Odysseus has to sort of set forth onto the great ocean, never knowing, you know, what will happen. Will there be enough wind? Will they get there? Will there be a big storm? So it struck me that the sea itself is one of the characters almost in the Odyssey, maybe the most important character, the sea, in which we set forth entirely vulnerable, just depending on circumstances beyond our control. So this first chapter of the book, after the introduction, is called The Sea of Stories. So I thought I'd read from that. Our lives are full of stories, inundated by them. The day begins with the drama of the morning news and continues with stories we hear from friends, family members, co-workers, acquaintances. Popular songs regale us with stories, as do the movies, the internet, the newspaper. Almost all our institutions, from business to psychotherapy, from school to pulpit, organize their messages through story. And at night, we fall asleep to tales told in books, magazines, or television. And even our dreams weave our souls into the spell of stories. You'd think we would tire of stories, that we would have heard it all by now. But our appetite for them is unabated. Creating, processing, and interpreting stories is a major industry. Probably many of you work in this industry. And at any given moment, there are literally millions of people working on the creation of new stories that we will consume, discuss, fret about, dote over, forget, and remember. This human obsession with stories is as old as language. Long before the printing press or even the written word, people told stories in verse or in song. They were blurted out loud during walking or working, or whispered at night, declaimed from the holy places. People remembered and invented stories, sacred stories, profane stories, jokes, parables, fairy tales. From childhood, we gravitate toward the good story and its endless fascination. Tell it again, children have always said. Probably now more than ever, we have access to stories from all cultures, all times, more stories every day than you could possibly absorb or pay attention to. If you listen to stories closely and critically and long enough, you begin to discern patterns. Boy meets girl, loses girl, gets girl back. Pride leads to a fall. Within happiness lurks the seed of tragedy. Power corrupts. The world wears down a noble character. Love suffocates. We need to break free. A hero overcomes an evil adversary. In all stories, there's conflict or pressure, tension that builds to a release. Action rises, crests, falls. Stories end happily, sadly, or with open-ended questions. I suppose you can make a list of 10 or 20 or 50 or however many there are, plot lines. And almost all stories would fit into one or more of those categories. Just as we don't tire of looking at ourselves in the mirror, though we can be reasonably sure of what we're going to see there, we never get tired of stories, no matter how repetitive they may be, because stories reflect our hopes, our fears, our dreams, and through stories we can experiment with our lives without any consequences. Through them, we share the common human drama of which our life is but a small reflective sliver. But stories can be enormous distractions. Immersed in the latest soap opera, on television, in the newspapers, in the tabloids, or in the lives of our friends, we can avoid tending to what's real in our own lives. We can avoid the real truth or the real challenge of our own living. We can fail to notice the real joys and the real horrors of this world. Many centuries ago, the Buddha noticed with compelling acuity the way in which absorption in stories, especially our own personal stories, could and usually did function as an avoidance mechanism to disastrous effect. Immersed in the passion of the tale, we forget who and what we really are. And heedless of our patterns of thought and behavior, we go on suffering driven and unexamined lives, and we hurt ourselves and others in the process. This is why the Buddha devised the doctrine of non-self or no-self, by which he meant not that the self did not exist, but that the self depicted in stories, in gossip and myth, and in our own repeating emotional tape loops is not a true self. Every story, by hooking us into its plot line and shaping us through its narrative structure, says far too much that is not true, and far too little that is. So as an antidote to the human obsession with stories, the Buddha taught moment-by-moment attention to the elements of perceptual, emotional, and intellectual experience. He once said, in the seen, let there be only the seen, and in the heard, only the heard. In other words, let go of the story and pay attention to the actual facts of your life. And when you do pay attention to these facts, the Buddha felt, without being swept away by the exciting plot line of your story, you will find that you can see what kind of thoughts and deeds lead to suffering and trouble, and what kind of thoughts and deeds will lead to happiness and peace. And when you see this clearly, you'll be able to choose what's happy over what's not happy, and your life is going to change a lot. And the lives of those around you will change because they're near you. And I think everybody in this room, or most of you anyway, have experienced this and see how meditation can help you in just this way. And yet, you just can't get around the stories, can you? Our own story or anyone else's story. Because to be human is to tell your tale and to listen to someone else's. But it would make a difference to know that stories are stories. They are real, but not in the way we think they are when we take them too earnestly and allow them to mesmerize us. Stories are true as stories, but that doesn't make them real life. They require interpretation and reflection if we are to draw lessons from them. Stories teach us through their shapes, their sounds, their structures, their suggestions, their in-between-the-lines content that speaks to us through our souls rather than our minds or even our hearts. To know that my story is not exactly mine, but is rather a wave rising up within the sea of stories, is to appreciate my story and everyone else's in a new, a wider, and a more significant way. Maybe by looking at stories in this way, we can see them as large and mysterious. Then perhaps we won't need any longer to cling to one particular version of our story as the only true story, the story of victimization, or trivialization, or despair, or boredom. Instead, we might begin to see our many stories as stories of humanness, of being aliveness, not just our own small possessions. And then perhaps we can be inspired by our own stories and begin to make use of them in a new way. So that's a little section from that part of the book. And I'd like to try a little experiment now, if you don't mind. Let's try this. We'll just see what happens. The book includes a series of little meditations so that you can personalize and reflect on the things that are being said. And in the book at this point, there is one of these little meditations, and I thought we could try it right now if you're willing. Okay? You ready for this? Let's see what happens. So if you could go back to your meditation posture just for a moment. Find your breath. Return to your center. And let's just be silent for a moment or two before we begin. So I'd like you to allow to arise in your mind's eye a moment from your early childhood, some memory that will just come up now, unbidden. Maybe a place where you played, or a look on someone's face, a sensation in the body, anything, whatever arises right now. And try to remember and make vivid that moment. And really, really be there. Project yourself there imaginatively as much as you can. And now, now you're older, maybe an adolescent. And bring forth another memory from that period if you can. A vivid moment. Just something that spontaneously arises. And see if you can be in that place and time. And now, in whatever way you can do it, tell yourself a story about your life, your life story. But instead of doing it in the usual way, as if it were a resume, you know, I was born here and went to school there and got married over here, got divorced over there, had this job. Tell it as if your life were a string of such moments. One after the other, over a period of time. And see how it feels to sing a new song about your life. So thank you for being willing to try that out. And now one more thing. I'd like everybody to turn to the person next to you, either on the right or the left. Everybody can find somebody. And let's just have a conversation, just 3 or 4 minutes, about what was that like? What did you learn from that? What did you feel in that exercise? If you don't know the person sitting next to you, exchange names. Hello, how are you? My name is so-and-so. And then just talk. Everybody, let's talk. What was that like? How was that? That was pretty lively. I have no doubt that we could have continued those conversations for a while, but we'll just leave it at that. So, any comments about that? Anybody want to say anything about that? Yeah. It was liberating. Yeah. Karen said so too. Where's Karen? Karen and I had a great talk, and she said the same thing. Yeah. Other people? Other comments? Yeah? Was that you? Want to make a comment? Yeah.
We just had two very different approaches to it.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering how the different approaches
to it. I think there's probably a lot of different approaches to it, yeah.
I just remember these different scenes that were not connected.
Uh-huh. Yes. Right. And the life that could be drawn by connecting those dots would be a very different life from the one that you are convinced that you is your life, right? So I think that's, to me, that's what you find out. One of the things you could find out is that, oh, so I've been convinced that this is my life. It's like this and like this and like this, and I've connected the dots along this trajectory. But actually, I could connect them this way, or this way, or this way. And I could have dozens of different life stories. So, therefore, why do I so much believe in this one? And why am I so invested in this one with all of its problems and shortcomings? Why don't I just tell myself that's one story? Okay, maybe it's true, but so is this other one, and so is this one, and so is that one. Something like that. Yeah, somebody else had a comment over here. Yes?
Yeah, I felt my child stuff.
Yeah.
I felt the emotional ups and downs. And I also felt the connection of that child relative to my experiences. And I began to understand why I feel certain ways today relative to what that child and adolescent was going through.
Wow. Just saved you $1,000 of therapy. That's wonderful. Yeah, that's great. I'm sorry, you didn't hear him. He was saying that he felt some emotions from childhood that explained to him a lot of the ways he feels about things today. That's what you said, more or less, yeah. Yeah. So, I've been doing this little exercise in different places as I've been traveling around with the book, and I've been actually astonished at how much comes out of it. And the book is full of these little different exercises, so it's interesting to see what could happen. Because I think the point is that we are so strongly conditioned to thinking about our life in a particular way. And, you know, maybe we're very smart and we spend a lot of time reflecting on our life, and maybe we have done therapy or all kinds of things to kind of figure out, you know, what's going on with us. But it's all been on a particular trajectory. And I think part of what I'm saying here is that maybe your life is actually told in the Odyssey. Maybe that's a story of your life. Maybe this journey home and all that happens on the journey home is actually not about Odysseus, it's actually about you. And this could be one of your stories. And a whole lot of other stories too. And so why would, like I said a minute ago, why would we need to be so convinced that this particular story is the whole of what we are? We're much more than this, is the point. We're all much, much more than this. And I think that, for me anyway, as I understand meditation practice, this is what its most profound effect on us, is that when we go to the cushion and we enter silence, you know, we see what's there, things come up, and maybe the things that come up we're quite used to, you know, they're very repetitive, we've seen them before, they come up, but we let them go. And if we sit there long enough, we gradually enter a larger space in which things that come and go are not so much self, we don't so much identify with them. We begin to identify with the silence, with the quiet, with the bigger space. And then within that space, much, much more is possible. Much more is possible. And this is not to deny whatever our, you know, predominant story is, but just rather to contextualize it in a much bigger context. And then everything, the way we approach our lives is very, very different then. So for me, this is really the essence of not only meditation practice, but all spiritual endeavor, is to create little by little through our daily exercises, through our retreats, through our practice ongoingly, because it's not a magic thing, you know, we sit down once and there it is. We cultivate it over time. We create a whole other context for who we think we are. And that's the point. And I think that's what our practice will do for us eventually. Somebody else had a comment. Yes.
I'm really attached to the stories of what happened to me growing up.
Yeah.
Why that happened.
Yeah.
What I tried to do was just go to the sensations of what was happening.
Yeah.
Simply what was happening.
Yeah.
And what if I was just fine? What if everything was cool?
Right.
If I believed that, how very different.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and if it's true, as you're saying, that you focus on a set of bad things that happened to you that felt very difficult, probably it's true that there were also days and moments and many times when you felt wonderful as a child, and you forgot about those. Those now have been excised from your story. So not to deny these things that happened that were difficult, but at the same time to remember also other things were going on. And there are other stories that are also there. And there's liberation, in other words, that's already present. It doesn't need to be effected or forced or created. It's already there. You just need to remember, oh, it's already there, I forgot. So anyway, we don't need any more comments on that unless somebody wants to make them. But if there's something, I think we have a few minutes. If there's something that anybody would like to speak about, meditation practice or anything else about the book that you'd like to ask, I'm happy to engage some questions or comments. Yes?
Did you just say the liberation's already there?
I did. Sounds like good news, doesn't it? Yeah. Did I just say that the liberation is already there? Yes, I did say that. And tell me more about it. Well, I think that our spiritual practice is not a job of work. It's not the kind of thing where we are more or less a mess, and now we have to roll up our sleeves and clean up that mess and improve ourselves. I don't look at it that way. I actually believe, and my experience tells me, that no matter what our situation is, no matter how many messes there may be, just as I was saying to you, that our fundamental liberation, our fundamental awakening, is built into our genes. It's there already. It's not a matter of producing it. It's a matter of recognizing the way we've tied ourselves up into knots and convinced ourselves that it's not there, and so are failing to see it. So it's not a matter of producing something as much as it is a matter of just letting go of all of our resistance and all of our insistence. We're so invested in our unhappiness and in our confusion and in our need to fix ourselves, to just let go of that. So it's more like letting go than it is like building something or making something. It's a lot less work than you think, actually. So that's what I mean. Maybe it's hard to believe, but I think it's actually true. Yes?
It's interesting to hear you talk about stories. It's just been such a theme for me this year, and I recently went to a retreat at Spirit Rock, and the part of the reason I went to the retreat was just because I'm so tired of all the stories. All the quiet was just...
Quiet, yeah.
And also the feeling of just direct experience. And it was an awakening in the body,
mm-hmm.
retreat. And it was just, feel this. You mm-hmm.
don't. So you were satisfied? You did escape a little bit from all those stories? Yeah.
What? Just trying to get away from all of it. You know,
uh-huh.
Oh, I'm reading Norman Fisher. Oh, my God. You know, this story.
Right.
You know, Susan's, oh, my God, this story. You know,
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yes.
And so tonight, though, when I was sitting, one of the things you kept saying and people say is, you know, appreciate life and appreciate, and sometimes I think, what does that mean to appreciate life? You know, it's like, you know, is it, am I supposed to believe that this is some marvelous thing?
Uh-huh.
Who's, you know, what story? I don't get it.
Uh-huh.
So tonight, when, you know, just breathing and feeling, and you said, and this is what life feels like. And then I said, oh, that kind of appreciation, it's just recognizing
uh-huh.
that this is what life
mm-hmm.
feels
mm-hmm.
in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's not a story, it just is. And that was really a loving moment.
Oh, I'm glad. Now I have to repeat everything you just said.
No.
Yes. So that everybody can... Did everybody hear it? Yeah. Sorry. I promised our sound person that I would repeat all the questions, but yeah. But everybody did hear, right? You all heard that. Okay. What else? Yeah. Oh, one thing I wanted to say is that one of the problems, though, is that after the Spirit Rock retreat is over, then life resumes. So I think that to me it's a very, very important thing to recognize that our meditation practice is not for the purpose of helping us escape from our lives. Now, to be sure, we might be in a position sometimes in our lives where we absolutely do need to escape, and a little bit of escape is okay. But it's not an ongoing strategy. It doesn't really work out. Because, believe me, as somebody who lived for more than 25 years in monastic and semi-monastic enclosures, I can tell you that being on retreat constantly is not the answer. Because the only reason why it seems like a good idea is because it's temporary. But if it were your permanent condition, then everything would just come back in that situation. So there's really no escape from our life. And the meditation practice is not to get us to escape to some peace for a little while, but it's to get us to become wise so that we know how to live our lives with some happiness and some appreciation. But I'm glad that you had that moment of realizing, oh, appreciate my life. It's a very simple thing. It's a very simple thing to appreciate that you're in a body, that you can breathe, that you can think, that you can speak, that you can see. These are incredible gifts. Not a big deal, but yet a really big deal in another way. Yeah. Oh. Upstairs. I'm sorry. You know, the upstairs people are kind of like above my ability to imagine you. So there you are up there. Yeah.
I was struck. I heard there's a story. And the story is there's something wrong with you. That's one version. And, you know, and I've heard that, and I saw a book by a Zen teacher. The title is "There's Something Wrong with You."
Yeah. Yeah. You mean because you're convinced there's something wrong with you, or?
I mean, because it is such a visual sort of sense that the story is like there's something wrong with you, and there's this getting rid of the something that's wrong over time.
Yeah.
You know, it's
right,
like
right.
That there needs to be that time where I'm really screwed.
Yeah.
So, and I'm wondering, so I have these moments of sort of freedom that maybe this is really true. There really is something wrong with me, except that I don't know it.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And it feels great for about 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the tenacity of the story?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's something wrong with me. Why is that such a strong and convincing story? Why is it that when there's a moment when you realize it's not true, immediately you go back to the old story? Well, I think that we have a tremendous investment of identity in that story. I mean, it's the strangest thing, but you come to realize that the very longing to no longer have something wrong with you reinforces the concept that there's something wrong with you. That's really how it works. There's a tremendous energy of identity wrapped up in that. And almost a fear that would go away, that you wouldn't feel that anymore. So in other words, even as you're hoping and hoping and hoping and working really hard that feeling would go away, you really don't want that feeling to go away because you're really convinced that that's who you are. And you really need that. So it's a kind of a crazy thing, but I think we do this to ourselves all the time. And so I think that the best practice for that is a kind of, I think, a mental yoga. Not something that you do just in meditation practice, but all the time. Whenever you catch yourself in that train of thought, in that frame of mind, you have to stop right there and say to yourself over and over again, this is a habitual thought. Because it's not a fact. It's actually not a fact. It is a habitual thought. So therefore, it's really painful. You know, it's a serious thing. I'm not diminishing it. It's a serious thing. But you've got to understand what kind of a serious thing it is. It's not the kind of serious thing that's a fact that you need to change. It's the kind of serious thing that it's a strongly habitual thought. And when you stop right there and you say, this is a very strong habitual thought, you are changing the game. And you have to repeat that over and over and over again until you really discipline yourself to know what it is. And then once you know what it is, it loses its power. And little by little, you can overcome it. It's just a real strong habit. And many of us have this habit. You're not the only one. I wish you were the only one, you know. You know, then it would be okay. Let's work with you, and then, but actually, it's most of us, you know, most of us. It's an epidemic, you know, it's an epidemic. But it's just a strong habitual thought. It isn't a fact. It really isn't a fact. I mean, why is it that it's illegal to murder people? It's illegal to murder people because we understand that human life is sacred, right? Don't we know that? That's why you can't beat people up and so on. You get arrested. Human life is sacred. Oops, there's one exception. Your life is not sacred. Because there's something wrong with you. No, I don't think there is any exceptions. Actually, your life is sacred. Your life is holy. And it is. That's the fact. And then there's these habitual thoughts that intervene. So, good luck with that. And maybe you'll take my suggestion and pretty soon you won't have that thought anymore. You don't really need it anyway. Yeah, thanks. I think, oh, that means it's the end. I'll be happy to sign books later on if anybody wants to buy a book and we could talk more. But I think it seems like the end, don't you think? Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.